I was, you know, having out-of-body experiences. And it just got to the point after a couple days that I just couldn't take it.
Then it's infecting people, and it eventually runs out of people to infect, and that's when you get flattening out and sort of the slowing down of the infection rate.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. Thanks for listening to the podcast during these trying times. I hope you're staying safe. On today's episode, I'll speak with an RPI computer science professor who's trying to use computer modeling to track when the Capital Region will see its peak of the coronavirus pandemic. But first, I want to play you this story by our Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief and weekend anchor Lucas Willard. A friend of his nearly died from the virus. Unlike many of the stories we've heard so far, this one has a happy ending.
In early April, I became one of the increasing number of Americans to share the same unsettling experience. I learned that a friend of mine was recently hospitalized for COVID-19. I've known Dave Turner for about a decade. He lives in Brooklyn and works on film sets. He's tall, broad-shouldered, and surfs. He's 34. So I found it shocking to learn that he recently was released from the ICU in Virginia. I reached out to him, and we set up a call, which we recorded.
Hey, bud. How you doing?
How's it going, man?
Before displaying symptoms of the coronavirus in March, Dave was isolating with his girlfriend. He thinks he might have gotten it at the grocery store, but he really doesn't know where he contracted it. He first started feeling something wasn't right on March 19th, less than 3 weeks after the first lab-confirmed case of COVID-19 was recorded in New York.
I didn't actually feel sick. I just got bad sleep, and I woke up like completely sweating. But I kind of think that was the first symptoms, because then the next day on the 20th, I was feeling a little weird during the day, and I thought it was because I was just tired from the night before. But then by the nighttime, like right when we went to have dinner, I just turned, I basically just knew right there that I was sick.
At first, it was headaches.
But then a couple days later, that's when the extreme nausea started. And I know that's not a symptom that everybody who's been getting this got, but it really severely attacked my digestive system.
From March 20th to the 25th, Dave's headaches and nausea got worse. He couldn't sleep. His fever climbed to 103 degrees.
And then, so I was feeling this tightness in my chest, which was manageable during the day. But at night, once it got late, like 10 p.m., I like knew that the second like 10 p.m. hit, it was going to get worse.
Dave and his girlfriend first started contacting doctors over telemedicine, but it was confusing.
It was just getting to the point that the doctors were all telling us different things. Whichever doctor you would get, one doctor would be like, don't take any Advil. And then the next doctor would be like, take 600 milligrams of Advil and Motrin.
Anti-nausea meds weren't really working, and his fever wouldn't budge. He started to consider going to the emergency room, which for him was a tough pill to swallow on its own.
For many reasons. I mean, just the expense of it, the fact of the matter that I'm not like a let's go sit in the emergency room kind of guy.
I'm familiar with Dave's aversion. 10 years ago, I saw him remove a cast from his leg with a pair of tin snips because he didn't want to go to the hospital. But he was coughing in terrible pain, and the sickness was unbearable.
So I just basically couldn't take it anymore and went to the hospital in Brooklyn.
Dave sat in the waiting room for an hour. Then he was led to an exam room. The door was closed, and he waited for 2 more hours.
I, at one point, was screaming for help, and no one came. I mean, I could have been dead in that room. I mean, someone who was in worse condition lung-wise than me, I mean, they had no idea my condition. No one had checked anything yet. No one had checked any vitals. No one had done a single thing with me. I was on the floor of an exam room in pain, screaming for help.
Eventually, Dave opened the door and in the hospital hallway began asking for a nurse.
That's how swamped these hospitals were in Brooklyn. I mean, there was no one around. I was just thrown in a room and just left there.
When Dave went to the hospital in Brooklyn on the night of March 25th, the coronavirus had all but exhausted New York hospitals of PPE. He didn't see face shields or protective gowns on the nurses.
The nurses in the New York hospital had the same dinky masks that like people walking around on the street have, and that's it. And they even told me, a nurse told me, they couldn't even get tested if they wanted to themselves. And they wouldn't test me. I think I asked to be tested. So they wouldn't test me. They really wouldn't give me any treatment. I almost felt worse from even having gone there, and then the nurses are all going to get sick.
He was given 4 bags of saline and anti-nausea meds. His oxygen levels were checked, and he was deemed healthy enough to go home. 6 hours after checking in, he left around 4 a.m.
I tried to sleep. I tried to feel better. I felt actually a little better after all those fluids for a few hours.
While Dave and his girlfriend had been isolating in New York, his girlfriend's mother had suggested they come stay with her in Virginia, in a basement sealed from the rest of the house. Initially, they were cool to the idea, but Dave's condition worsened.
It got to the point that she saw how bad my symptoms were, and we were like, well, what happens if her symptoms get like that?
There was no way Dave was going to another New York hospital. They decided to drive that evening.
But I just want to say the drive was harrowing. The drive was bad.
Dave's nausea wasn't abiding. He threw up before the car left the curb. Then it was another 6 grueling hours.
I couldn't take a deep breath because I knew I'd cough. And if I coughed, it was a lot of pain. So I was breathing so shallow, my girlfriend kept having to check with her hand that I was still breathing. And it was around this time that I was just so delirious that I was just in such a dark place. I mean, I sent messages to people like my sister that I didn't want to live anymore, that I couldn't take it anymore, I couldn't fight it anymore, that I almost don't even remember sending. You know, I mean, I was ready to die in that car.
They made it to the hospital in Virginia.
I remember they pulled me out of the car and they had kind of like an emergency intake area built out of like a tent outside the hospital.
The first thing Dave noticed was the PPE. The intake staff was outfitted with masks, face shields, disposable gowns, everything.
I think I told them, like, I don't want to die, and I, you know, I'm just extremely sick and I need help.
He was brought into a pediatric ward that had been converted into a coronavirus emergency room. In a small sealed room, Dave, barely able to talk, was given morphine.
And the morphine, once it really kicked in, was the first time I was able to speak in hours. I didn't realize that pain, you know, was that much of a contributor to me not being able to talk, but whatever it was, I was able to speak. Then they gave me a CAT scan. They wheeled me to the CAT scan room where I had to inhale and hold my breath, which was extremely difficult, and I don't think I could have done it if I wasn't on the morphine.
Dave was given more anti-nausea meds and painkillers, and that's when he was first tested for COVID-19.
I was tested for the flu. I was tested for coronavirus. I was tested for probably a bunch of other things. And I think while I was still in that ER is when they discovered that I had pneumonia in both of my lungs, in my lower lungs.
Dave tested positive for coronavirus. In the ICU, he was given oxygen and was monitored, but did not require a ventilator.
After the first day I was there, the hospital was talking about discharging me already because I didn't need to be put on a ventilator. So that decision got changed pretty quick, I guess, based on my conditions. And I was there for another day. And in the end, I basically started begging to leave. I couldn't sleep. It was really hard with IVs in both arms to do much of anything. Even as a normal person, when I'm healthy, I can't really sleep on my back. So it was nightmarish even in there, you know? And I was hallucinating. I was talking to different versions of myself about how I can get a couple minutes sleep. I was, you know, having out-of-body experiences. And it just got to the point after a couple days that I just couldn't take it anymore. And I guess I must have been feeling slightly better. And I just begged them from that morning. I mean, I wasn't sleeping, so every hour is kind of the same. But when the nurses changed over in the morning at whatever time, 9 a.m. or something, maybe even earlier, 8 a.m., I started asking to leave.
Dave was released on March 28th. His girlfriend, who had a dry cough, fever, loss of taste and smell, was never tested for coronavirus despite showing telltale symptoms. Dave was prescribed antibiotics and hydroxychloroquine, the anti-malaria drug that President Trump has touted as effective in treating COVID-19, though Dave said his doctors didn't know how effective the experimental treatment would be. It was a crapshoot. And nearby pharmacies were out of the drug. They had to drive 45 minutes to pick up the prescription.
My girlfriend was pretty great, and we had like a good schedule on the drugs I had to take and when I had to take them. And eventually, after another 3 days, I think I started being able to eat some solid foods. And that really, I think, turned things around.
Dave and his girlfriend quarantined for 2 weeks in the basement. Before returning to Brooklyn, Dave wonders what it will be like and if his symptoms will return.
I mean, we don't really know because the facts around coronavirus are still all up in the air, but we're hoping we're immune now. Which puts us in a much different boat than a lot of New Yorkers, and especially a lot of people in around the city or in any of the cities in New York. Because if we are immune, we're a lot safer than millions of people.
Dave got sick weeks before the peak of coronavirus in New York. He wasn't tested in his home state, so it's unlikely his case was recorded in the state's official count. He wonders how many other people are in the same situation. At the time of our interview, New York was still experiencing more than 600 deaths per day. Governor Andrew Cuomo had ordered non-essential workers to remain at home until May 15th. A decision had not been made to reopen schools, though several Northeast governors banded together to take a regional approach. Though President Trump said he would leave reopening up to the governors, he took to Twitter to encourage protesters in Michigan, Minnesota, and Virginia, states all led by Democratic governors, who were demanding the states reopen amid the crashing economy. A similar group of protesters had recently appeared outside the New York State Capitol in Albany. Dave, who hoped sharing the reality of his experience would maybe prevent someone else from suffering from the virus, followed the news in his recovery.
The only thing I can say is that I think it's astronomically stupid. Astronomically stupid, especially in New York. I mean, if anyone saw the things I saw in the hospitals there, they would not be doing it. I mean, I think it's just a matter of, unless you know someone that this happened to, or it happened to you, people find it hard to believe. And also because of the range of symptoms. The fact that my girlfriend could still function having the same virus that I did, and other people be completely asymptomatic or have very mild symptoms. You know, if you only know people with mild symptoms, then you think, oh, what's the risk? Oh, it's only old people dying. It's just the flu, yada, yada. But the reality is, you don't know. I mean, I'm 34 and healthy, and it almost took me out.
Dave said it was the healthcare workers in Virginia who saved his life. But the people on his mind the most, nearly a month after he developed symptoms, are those who risked their lives at work in the New York City hospital.
Like, I'm getting emotional right now, even thinking about it.
I first learned of Dave's illness through a text from a friend who had seen posts written by Dave on Facebook, the first on March 26th. Hundreds of well wishes and comments are on that page.
All I can say is that when I was in that hospital and I wasn't sleeping and I was delirious, that every piece of love that I felt helped me get through it. And even if I couldn't respond to people, like it was meaningful to me. And I really believe that that love has power physically.
I told him over the phone, it sounded like he was ready to start a new religion.
Yeah, maybe I'll start a cult after all this.
All right, now let's turn to my interview with RPI computer science professor Dr. Malik Magdan Ismail. He's been working on a machine learning model for predicting the impacts of the pandemic on smaller cities, like New York's Capital Region.
My main research thrust is machine learning. And And what that means is, you know, I'm given, I build models, algorithms, and sort of do the mathematics around. Someone gives me a data set, and they'd like to extract some information, some prediction, usually some projection. And so what we do is we build a model. We then calibrate the model, which we call learning. So we learn the model, we calibrate the model to the data, and the data doesn't have the information they want, for example, predictions where they want the predictions, but we can use the model that is calibrated to the data. We can use the model to make those predictions. So that's my main research thrust. And so what got me interested in this problem was, you know, the fact that, you know, early on, early March, there was a lot of uncertainty about the nature of this pandemic and, you know, is asymptomatic infection a large impact on the way the disease spreads and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of uncertainty. And I thought, what does the data say? So that got me looking into the data. And once I got into the data, I started collecting the data and I started analyzing the data at a very superficial level, and I realized that, oh, this is exactly in the sweet spot of my expertise, which is we have a little bit of data, and we'd like to understand, we'd like to make predictions on things like when will the infection rate start decreasing, what will the total number of infections be, and so on and so forth. So it's exactly the framework that I typically focus on research, which is I have a little bit of data, and I'd like to make predictions, and then this is a very nice application of that.
Based on the summary that I read before we got on the phone together, it seems that the idea of keeping people home, the social distancing, is vital here, right? That your projections found that the peak would come later with more people infected in the capital region if only half of everybody was staying home, as opposed to if three quarters of the population stayed home, we would see an earlier peak with fewer infections. Is that correct?
So that's a good summary of what the model predicts. And there are two main things going on in the model as far as how we're modeling the pandemic. The one main thing is, you know, how quickly does this infection spread? How quickly does the virus spread? And the other main thing that's going on is, you know, how many people does the virus have available to infect? And so typically when you observe such a pandemic, you'll see this steep rise in the number of infections, then it's sort of what we say flattens out, and then you start seeing a decrease in the number of infections. So what's going on there is the steep rise is sort of telling you how quickly this thing can infect people, but then it's infecting people and it eventually runs out of people to infect, and that's when you get flattening out and sort of the slowing down of the infection rate. And if you keep more people at home, you're affecting that second thing, which is how many people does the virus have to infect. And indirectly, when you do social distancing, you're also affecting the rate at which it can infect people. And so by controlling these two parameters, you can drastically change when it peaks out. And also you can drastically change how many people will get infected. The simple reason why you change how many people get infected is you've just allowed it to infect fewer people by keeping more people at home.
Governor Cuomo has been talking about that in the last couple of days as we speak, saying if you can keep the number of people that the average person infects under 1 to 0.9, then you can stop the spread. But if that goes over 1 to 1.2 people apiece, then it starts to become a really hard math problem. Is that basically right?
That's more or less right. There's this famous number in sort of epidemic spreading models, which is this number 1. And you can think about it this way. If before I get cured, I infect, let's say, more than one person, say 2 people, then once I'm cured, I disappear, but 2 people appear and things have grown. On the other hand, if you can get me down to below 1, then gradually the thing will disappear. So this critical threshold of 1 is very crucial to being able to sort of hold the infection at bay.
How will the model change now that there's more testing available, even in places like the capital region?
Okay, so The model that I've been using is primarily based on what I call early data. So the infections as they're coming, but we're early in the sort of pandemic, up to let's say April 10th or 11th, and I am sort of basing it off the fact that, you know, who goes to get tested. So what are the people that we are seeing who are testing COVID positive are the people who were serious enough to go and get tested. So that's the model. That's sort of the one of the assumptions behind this model, which is you go and get tested when you feel sick. And later on, we might start implementing, and some countries have implemented random testing models where you don't just test people who feel sick, you test people in a random way. That'll affect actually the data, and it'll also affect the modeling and the modeling assumptions. And you know, if we were able to test everybody every day, then we would be able to control the disease much more efficiently than the current state, which is, you know, we really only test people who come to us when they're sick.
Right. And also, I think it should be pointed out, we don't actually know if 75% of the people are staying at home, right?
Ah, we do not. So that's one of the things that the model cannot learn from the data. So this is one of the things where you can do what we call scenario analysis. So I've analyzed the scenario where 75% of the people stay at home. We can analyze the scenario where 80% stay at home, 50%, 20%. What's the right number? It's hard to judge. And from my perspective, I'm doing the scenario analysis, but other people might have a lot more insight on what exactly that number is. And if you give me that exact number, then I can plug it in.
Are any capital region organizations or governments taking this data from you to help plan that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. It's available. You know, I'm happy to help out in whatever way I can, because, you know, this is the only way I can help out. I'm not on the front lines. I can just help with understanding what's going on. Did I send you an email?
Yeah, I'm looking at some photos right now. I'm not going to pretend to know exactly what I'm looking at, but maybe you can explain.
Yes. You should see a bunch of red dots.
Yes.
Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about what those red dots are. So if you know, you can see dates, right? So for example, 3:30 mm-hmm. is March 30th. And if you go up to the dot that corresponds to 3:30, it's somewhere around 20. So vertical, mm-hmm. the vertical axis, you know, it's somewhere around 2, but you got to multiply by 10 because the scale is a times 10 scale.
Got it.
Okay, so that red dot that corresponds to 3:30 means that approximately 20 confirmed infections on 3:30. Okay, now why do I say approximately? Because the number that I have here is the number that was reported by DOH. The DOH reports the number when they get the confirmed positive test. We don't know when that actual test actually became a confirmed positive, so we don't know when the test was requested. And it's approximate because it's only the people who went to get tested who are coming back with confirmed positives. We don't know how many people are out there who are positive and asymptomatic, for example.
Okay. Yeah, that's been the big problem here, obviously.
Yeah. So these red dots, you look at these red dots and it shows you how many confirmed infections we've had every day. And, you know, it's going up to about April 10th. So I'm going to ask you, look at these dots and tell me what's going to happen. Okay. And you're going to probably tell me, well, that's a very hard problem. It doesn't look like it's even solvable. And that's what we're trying to solve by the machine learning approach, which says, let's take an epidemiological model, a simple one, and try to explain this data using this simple model. And the model can explain this data, but we'd really like to know what's going on May 29th.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the data doesn't go out to May 29th. So that's where the model comes in. The model then says, listen, you don't have data to May 29th, but the model, which explains the data you have so far, can still give you something to look at for May 29th. Now you'll see this magical black line. So that black line is this model that we, in the language of sort of machine learning, we might say has been fit to the red dots. So it explains the red dots. And you can see sort of it goes up steeply, and you can probably guess that steep decline is corresponding to the first episode of social distancing. Then it starts going up again. Then it spikes down. That's the lockdown. And then it starts going up again.
Hmm.
So that's the black line. The black line is the model. Now, let me emphasize, the model has only been sort of calibrated to the red dots, but the model exists everywhere. I'm a model. I fit the data. I'm consistent with what you've seen so far, and here's what I say later on. And then we use the model to project because we don't have data where we really want to know what's going on. And in this case, the model has sort of is indicating that, you know, we're going to peak out somewhere around late May, early June.
I guess the question is, are you updating with new data beyond the original red dot inputs?
Yeah, so every time I get, you know, every 1 or 2 days when the DO, so the DOH is updating the data daily as it gets reports every day. And then when I get a new red dot, I can put it in here, rerun the numbers, rerun the model, and the predictions might change slightly. So this is very similar. The analogy is like this. I want to know how much rainfall will occur in Albany by the end of the summer. And I have a nice weather model, but, you know, it's going to give me a prediction for the end of the summer, and that prediction is going to have a very large range, and that corresponds to the gray region you see in the picture. And as I get closer to that date, incorporating more data and more, you know, cloud cover, what have you, from the more recent days, my prediction will get more and more accurate.
So it would appear that the social distancing policies, the shutting of social life, more or mm-hmm. less, according to the model, is going to have the desired effect by May or June in that the number of cases will level off. And we're talking about the capital region here.
Yes.
So presumably, and maybe you don't want to answer this because it's speculation, but when we've heard discussion about a second wave, that is mm-hmm. because the social distancing policies are relaxed, and then more people are coming in contact with more other people who may or may not be positive, and that might cause this model to adjust upward, right?
Yeah. So what's happening here? So this black curve and the gray region, I'll tell you more about the gray region a little later. This
okay.
black curve, let's focus on the black curve. So this black curve is based on two things affected. Remember I talked about how many people are available for the virus to infect, and what's the rate at which it infects people. And the rate at which it infects people, the model tries to figure out from observing how the red dots are behaving. So it tries to figure this out. But however, the way the red dots are behaving doesn't tell you so much information about how many people are available to be infected. That's a number that I'm putting in as 75%, you know, and it's a guess. To some extent, I'm using what I see around me. To some extent, I'm using sort of like estimates from mobility data that Google has put out, which suggests that, you know, non-essential business in the Albany region has dropped by, you know, somewhere between 60% to 70%. So I'm using an educated guess to say 75% of people are staying at home, and that's why we get this curve. Now, one of the uses that we can put this model to is to say, okay, supposing on May 29th, you know, when we think we're peaking out, we relax the 75% restriction and allow people to slowly, in some phased manner, go back to normal life. So let's say we come down from 75% staying at home to 50% staying at home. Well, it's easy enough to plug that number 50% instead of 75% into the model and then see what will happen to this curve. And what you're saying is true, that one of two things can happen is that, you know, the turnaround and the decay may slow down a little because all of a sudden you've given the virus more people to infect, and so it's just going to go around and infect them. Or it could even restart and continue to rise because you've given it way more people to infect, and instead of peaking out, it says, hey, I've got a new pasture, and I'm going to go and infect that. So these are some of the things that could play out, and it depends a lot on some of the things that people are talking about, which is how many people, even though you peaked out on, you know, on the end of May with a certain number of confirmed positives, how many people out there have been unconfirmed positives, sort of asymptomatic positives who've sort of recovered and who have sort of built what people are terming herd immunity to this virus? What that means is that even though you've opened up the population a little more, there's also a lot of this group of people that are immune who might be able to sort of buffer the newly opened up uninfected people from the people who are infected and prevent, you know, the infection going across just because I'm immune.
So, all right, what does the gray area represent then?
The gray area is, you know, to make a long story short, uncertainty. So, if you ask me for a prediction, okay, on May 29th, I'm going to go to the black curve and say, I think on May 29th or whatever, end of May, we're going to have around 700 infections per day approximately, but we'll have peaked out and it's going to start dropping. Okay. What the gray region says is it really addresses how did I get that black curve? And how did I get that black curve was I looked at the red dots and I said, you know, that's the data. Find me the model that's consistent with the data. And then I'm going to use that model to predict out. But then when I look at the data, I find that there are lots of different models that are minor tweaks from each other that are still just as consistent with the data. And so the question is, what should I do with all these models that more or less look equivalent when it comes to explaining the data? So the idea is I should incorporate all those models into this gray region. So what this gray region says is there are some models or some scenarios which sort of peak out mid-June. Some scenarios, if you look at follow the bottom gray curve, peaking out, you know, around 10th of May. And so if you ask me for a range of when the peak out would be, it would be around 10th of May to, let's say, 10th of June. So that gray region represents a whole host of models that are all equally consistent with the data, which are the red dots. And then you might ask, well, why are there a whole host of models that are equally consistent with the data? And that comes back to the data and how hard a problem that was. When I showed you only the data, you saw the data and you said, oh, this is a hard task to predict what's going on in the future. And that's because the data has a lot of uncertainty in it. You see this jumping up and down in the data?
Yeah.
That jumping up and down is very hard to believe that that's actually what's going on. This is just a bunch of random effects that are taking place, some of them having to do with reporting, some of them having to do with, you know, which people decide to go and get tested and so on and so forth. So that randomness in the data, that sort of irregular behavior of the data is absolutely the norm when you look at any real data. And what that usually translates into is there are going to be many models that are equally good at explaining the data. And you need to take all those models into consideration when you make a prediction. And that's what the gray region is.
And so your model is saying it's plausible on the one hand that we could see, you know, X number of cases well above, you know, what could happen, or X number of cases well below that line. That is,
yes,
they all have a fair chance of happening the same.
A reasonable chance of happening, yes.
I don't want to get you in trouble here, so I want to say clearly this is me saying this, but Governor Cuomo in a press conference on Friday said that when President Trump was criticizing him for his request for all these ventilators that the state was seeking, it was based on a model. And that model ended up not being what happened in reality. So I'm imagining that people shouldn't misunderstand that to say that, you know, a high estimate doesn't necessarily mean that it was the wrong policy.
Well, this is really outside my expertise, but yes, a high estimate doesn't necessarily mean wrong policy.
So that sets me up to ask this question. What do you wish that the average person out there understood about how these predictions are made and how this work is done?
So one of the reasons why, for example, the average person might look at this and say, you know what, you know, you got it wrong by more than 100.
That's what I'm getting at, exactly.
Yeah, you got it wrong by more than 100. And there are two sort of points that I'd like to make. The first is, this is an inherently hard problem. So you got a little bit of data because we are trying to make predictions very early in the game. I mean, there's no point in making a prediction or looking back a year later and saying, oh, we could have done this and that. So the real challenge is for modelers and, you know, public health officials and epidemiologists and so on to make a prediction, let's say, after 10 days of watching what's going on, or 20 days, not 120 days. And so when you have a little bit of data, you know, there is going to be a large range in the predictions. And one of the things that, you know, is useful for the public to keep in mind is that this range is existing partly because we're trying to make such an early prediction. So then why make the prediction at all? Which is that, you know, we need something. We need to base our actions on something. And something that can come out of these red dots is things like these ranges. So, you know, if we explain that these ranges are sort of what they are, and you can set your expectations to these ranges, then people might understand the context in which we're trying to do this modeling. I mean, the analogy I give is, you know, ask a weatherman to tell you how much rain will there be in the Capital District by the end of the summer. And, you know, okay, rain in Albany is nothing compared to coronavirus, but you can see that it's very hard to predict, you know, the total amount of rain over an extended period, and there'll be a large range in that prediction. But we've sort of grown accustomed to weather predictions having these uncertainties. And so, you know, when we look at the temperature a week from now and we observe that, hey, it was 10 degrees off from, you know, what you predicted a week ago, we don't feel so bad because, you know, it's just the temperature. But that's sort of the inherent nature of the problem, and we've gotten used to it. Whereas in this case, it's a very high impact prediction. And though we'd like to have it as accurate as we can, the reality is that the data doesn't allow it.
Dr. Malik Magdan Ismail is professor of computer science at RPI. Professor, thank you so much for taking this time.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Hang in there. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.